John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. A new study shows that the majority of America's poor aren't just sitting at home collecting welfare. That runs counter to the popular narrative. The 1996 Clinton administration welfare reform plan posited that encouraging the poor to seek work would result in fewer people needing help. Common wisdom? Jobs will lift people out of poverty. But has that happened? Well, it depends on how you look at the numbers. And so, we have sociologist Scott Sanders, associate professor of sociology at Brigham Young University, joining us today on the Kathleen Dunn Show to talk about new research into the phenomenon known as the working poor. Professor Sanders, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start out by what prompted you to do this study in the first place.
That's a great question. I think one of the things that prompted this study most of all is we have a lot of research right now looking at poverty, people trying to figure out how to improve the situation of people not being able to meet their needs. But there's this segment of that, the working poor, that's gotten less attention. And one reason for that is it's difficult to define it. And our study goes through and just talks about the different ways. Are you going to define it by part-time work, full-time work? Are you looking at total household income or just head of household income? There's over 120 different measures that we analyze in our paper to try to define what the working poor is. And because of that, there's so many different ways of cutting the numbers up. There haven't been as much work on it or I guess, press on it as well. So this paper really was there to help try to get people to rally around like one idea of working poverty and to be able to help therefore move forward to find real solutions to help millions of Americans who are working but not making their needs.
Okay, so there are a lot of variables here, a lot of different kinds of questions you could be asking, but you came up with some key questions as you sought to define the term working poor. Can you talk about what you ended up deciding were the key measures or the key things you had to look at or the key questions that had to be answered?
Yeah. Well, one of the first ones is who are you going to be looking at? Who are the workers? Are you going to be looking at people 18 to 64, all people 18 to 64? Are you going to be looking at just the head of household, one worker per household, or do you think everyone in the household should be working? So that's one of the first questions you need to answer and how it's been there, how there's different definitions. Also, how are you going to be measuring work is another one. Are you going to be doing it by full-time work, part-time work, any work at all? And then is it by weeks, how many weeks you work in a year, how many hours you work in a year? So just by that definition of work, that can vary significantly too. Also, the definition of poverty, that's a big one too. There's lots of different ways you can measure poverty. Are you going to use the official government line? Are you going to use a relative measure where you're looking at people who are making 50%, less than 50% of the typical U.S. family income? Are you going to use 125% of the official threshold? There's different lines there to look at. So those are just some of the big questions you can start cutting the numbers up based off of how you're going to answer those questions.
Well, one of the things that strikes me as I read your research and various other articles about poverty in the United States, and that is the number focus seems to be a lot on income. We measure income as a measure of poverty. But I see less out there about what people have to spend, for example, what housing costs are like in various places in the United States and how that factors into whether a person is in poverty or not. I mean, we have people working pretty much full time in this country who still can't afford a place to live. How does the cost side of this equation factor into your research?
That's where we try to look at different levels of poverty for that. And that's one of the problems we have right now using an absolute measure of poverty, which is what we have as the official poverty line. For example, right now the official U.S. poverty line for a family of four is only about $24,000 a year. So it's not very much. And in some areas of the country, that can be even less depending on the cost of housing and living expenses as well. So that's why we use different levels of poverty. If you're using a relative one where you're looking at people who make less than 50% of the typical U.S. family or individual incomes, then you're seeing, well, who are just the people at the very bottom of the U.S., regardless of where you're going to draw that poverty line. And that's a more popular relative terms of measures of poverty. That's what typically we see done in Europe. So you're right, that poverty line can be very problematic depending on costs and regions. Different parts of the country cost more or less than others, and it's not flexible to that. But that's something that people who are looking at poverty are aware of, and there's more research that are trying to make more of a robust and realistic measure of poverty.
Yeah, because it seems to me that there aren't too many places in the United States where you could keep a roof over your head with an income of $11,000 a year.
Yeah. No, you're very true. Some people argue that the official U.S. poverty line is outdated. I have a colleague who works in San Francisco. He's an HR VP, and they had a program to raise money for people making $60,000 or less, because that's what the local charity thought was poverty in San Francisco, where if you take that money somewhere else, that's a good income. So it's really tough right now to do that, and there's measures trying to adjust per geography as well. And that's, like I said, that's one reason why for us we went through a bunch of different, four or five different measures of poverty to try to account for that, to show that, well, maybe if we make it a little bit more robust, how does that change the numbers? How does that change the picture of what we see today with the working poor?
Why isn't there an existing standard for determining exactly who qualifies as working poor?
I think because it's a study that's come out of the poverty. So the U.S. poverty line is pegged there so we know who qualifies for U.S. government assistance or not. That's one of the big reasons why it's an official line, is just to see who's going to be able to qualify for aid in some certain programs. And so working poor is something that scholars have realized is occurring and try to define themselves. And just by making certain assumptions or different definitions of what you want to call working, you can get wildly different answers. It's somewhat like the political campaigns right now, where one candidate will say, well, the figure is A, and they say another candidate will say, no, my figure is B. Both are true. It's just depending on where you're cutting the line. And people are doing this for various reasons. They're interested in what does full-time work look like? What does part-time work look like? So, again, that's why we try to do everything possible to show the spectrum of working poor. And then we did an analysis to try to show, well, this is the one we believe is the most convincing line for working poor.
And hourly wage factors into that as well?
Yes, we did both hourly wage. You can adjust it or non-adjust the income. So based on if they're working full-time off of hourly wage or if it's a weekly wage. So we adjusted for both measures like that.
800-642-1234, the number to call to join the program today. It's a different number than the one you're used to for the Kathleen Dunn Show. Kathleen out today. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. 800-642-1234. Email address is talk@WPR.org, and you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave a comment or a question. We're talking about the working poor in America on this hour of the Kathleen Dunn Show, wondering what you think. Perhaps you or a family member are one of the working poor. What do you think is needed to lift yourself up out of the situation that you're in now? Maybe it's better pay, maybe it's more hours, maybe it's a different job. What do you think would work? And do you feel that that our leaders are doing enough? What more do you think could be done? And for some of you may be surprised at what you're hearing, because what we're talking about this hour runs counter to the narrative about poverty in America. Maybe you already realized it. Share your views with us at 800-642-1234, talk@WPR.org, or on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. So, based on the way you chose to frame the questions in your research, and overcome some of the challenges that you faced in coming up with some of those definitions, what answers did you get? Let's start with maybe a general question, and then we can get into some specifics as we continue on through the hour here. But if we had to maybe give a one-sentence definition of what it means to be working poor in the United States, what would it be?
So the simple definition is that you're not making enough money to meet your basic needs, not making enough money to be above the poverty line. But at the same time, you or someone in your household is also working. So you're trying to make income, you're trying to meet your basic needs, but that job just doesn't simply provide enough money. That's the simplest way of getting at what working poor is.
So did you, I mean, I referenced the Clinton era Welfare Reform Act, 1996. It ended open-ended assistance. And the thinking then was that if we encourage people to get jobs, that they'll lift themselves out of poverty. Is this a case of where, well, that might have been true in 1996, but particularly, for example, since 2008, we've seen such a decline in wages that that's no longer true?
Yeah, that's what we're arguing in part in this study, is that before, when we thought about poverty, we thought about people who lacked employment. If we could just get them a job, then they'd be able to, and working, then they'd be able to provide for their needs. But what we're able to show is that of the 46 million Americans in poverty right now, about 24 million of them are working and still in poverty. So again, they're working and they're not making just basic needs. Like I said earlier before, if it's a household of four, $24,000 a year, they're not making that much, but they're out there working, trying to improve their lives.
So that's more than half of all of the people who meet the definition of poverty in the United States are working poor.
Yeah. So the majority of people in America right now are out there working. Majority of people who are poor are out there working. So, you know, one way to think about this is oftentimes in the media and in some people's visions, when we think about the American poor, we hear things about people living off the system. It's easier to take a check from the government than to work, or we think about panhandlers. But the reality of what America poor is today, a more accurate picture, is probably someone who is taking your order at a fast food restaurant or helping you check out at a grocery store. That's a more accurate image of what the American poor is today. People trying to work and trying to make make enough money for themselves and their families, but just simply aren't able to do so right now.
800-642-1234, the number to call to join the program. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Kathleen was out feeling she was a little under the weather yesterday, and she's still recovering from whatever bug has laid her low here for the moment. We're hoping that Kathleen feels better on Monday. We're sure she will, and she'll be back to do her program on Monday afternoon at 1 o'clock. We're talking about poverty in the United States, and specifically we're talking about the working poor. We'd like to hear from you. We're getting some calls and some emails. People are active on Facebook in the discussion. We appreciate that. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Scott Sanders will be here with us to answer your questions and continue our discussion. We're going to maybe get into a little bit of the nitty-gritty of this research. 24 million people in the United States working and at the poverty line or below. That was, when I saw that number, I have to say that was a stunning number for me, because it certainly runs counter to the narrative that we've accepted, some of us anyway, about poverty in the United States. A little bit of an eye-opener. Was it an eye-opener for you? Let us know. 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org or find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour on the Kathleen Dunn Show, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen out ill for a second day. We hope she'll feel better soon, and she is expected to be back on Monday. In the meantime, we will carry on with the discussion about the working poor today. My guest is Scott Sanders, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Brigham Young University, and one of a group of people who took a look at the working poor and have come up with some numbers that are challenging the popular narrative that the poor are poor because they choose not to work and rather be on assistance. Some 24 million, more than half of all of the people in poverty in the United States, are the working poor. That's what one of the things they found out in the study. Professor, let's talk a little bit about some. We identified 24 million people as being in poverty and working. That would represent what percent of the total American population?
That's about 11% of the total population that are working. So people who are employed, about 11% of them are therefore working and living in poverty.
Wow, that's more than one in ten of people who are working and in poverty. That's a pretty startling statistic. Did you Well, let's talk specifically, and you may have mentioned this, but I want to make sure we're clear for those who might be calling in with a question on this. Who are the workers as defined in your study, and how does that reflect to the changing demographics in the United States today?
So for that figure of the 24 million, we looked at a line that says people were working who worked part-time or half-time, either 27 weeks or more or 17 hours or more a week. And we looked at head of household. So we're just looking at a single provider for a whole household. And so that's where you can get some differences is if you're going to be looking at a single head of household or a whole household. And that's where that may not sound like a lot. That may sound like academic statistics, but it actually makes a difference when we start thinking about how we fix this. Because if we're interested in just having an America where we think that a single earner can go out or should be able to go out, get a job, work hard, and provide for their families, then that changes what kind of solutions we should have for the working poor. Maybe it's increased minimum wage or labor standards. If we want to say the working poor should be anyone in a household should go out and work, and then we need to start looking at things like child care. Who's taking care of the kids if we expect everyone to be out in the labor force? So it really is important when we start thinking about how we cut up these numbers. It's not just a statistical exercise, but it can have real impact on American lives depending on how we base the solutions.
Let's take some calls. We'll go to Ashland first, where Kim is with us. Kim, good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on some of this research. I have some experience as a middle manager for a major fast food restaurant. As management for the last 20-plus years, I can say that many, many, if not the majority at this point, of my employees are what we would consider working poor. In fact, some are homeless. And it's not unusual for these adults to work two or three minimum or low-paying jobs just to make ends meet. And actually, a lot of them don't make ends meet. So that's my comment, and I'll take your response off the air. Thank you.
Kim, thanks for that call. Professor, that's not an uncommon story in terms of your research.
No, and like I said before, I think it's a great example of what really is poverty in the United States right now. We have people who are out there working, playing by the rules, if you will, but not able to do it. And it raises a moral question, too, for a lot of us. Do we believe the American dream is still out there? And if not, if people like Kim was talking about who are working hard at jobs that are not fun, not easy, but they're out there trying to make some money to provide for their families, do we believe that America should still be a place where people can go out, work hard, and then still be able to provide for their families? Because the reality is now for millions of Americans, the American dream isn't there for them. They're working, but they're not able to meet just the basic needs for themselves and their families.
Well, some would question whether that American dream was ever really there to begin with. I mean, particularly if you look at the way the workforce has changed, the jobs that people used to go off to, the blue-collar industrial jobs with union wages and things like that, those pretty much gone in America today. Manufacturing sector way down, and the job growth seems to be in the service industries, fast food being one of them, as Kim points out, that American dream, if it existed, there doesn't seem to be anywhere near the basis for that these days.
Yeah, that's true. I don't see, and the numbers don't show that the American dream is a reality anymore. In fact, sometimes politicians talk about the working poor as a deserving poor, people who are trying to improve their lives but maybe need some assistance. And so if that's the case, then that raises both an economic and a moral argument. There are economic arguments for certain policies to help workers, to improve wages and labor conditions, but there may also be a moral issue there, too, that we want to live in a country where people can work and provide for their families. And if that's the case, then that moral and economic issue needs to come together when we talk about solutions for the working poor in America today.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Powers Lake, where Rick is on the line. Rick, hello. Rick, are you there? No, I think we lost Rick. Maybe we'll get him back. Okay, well, maybe not. Rick, if you're still listening, call back. Something obviously went wrong here. We lost your call, and it was one I really wanted to take. Of course, it's always the one that got away, right? So did you also take a look at the numbers by race, or what other demographic factors did you look at in your research?
So we looked at race, and that's where we see some shocking differences. So for non-Hispanic whites, using that measure we said before about people who are working half part-time, at least half the time, and a single head of family being the only earner, we see about 7.2% of the working population in whites are working poor. That's similar for Asians, which are 7.5, but it jumps up to 19.7% for blacks and 22.1%. So nearly one in five Hispanics and blacks who are working, who are in the labor force, are also in poverty. So we see huge racial discrepancies among working poor, and also increased likelihood of working poor if the head of household is a woman as opposed to a man.
Let's hear from Mary Kay in Kenosha next. Mary Kay, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening, gentlemen. Don't outsource our workers for cheaper labor. Paid wages versus volunteer work. More or less working hours to go back to college to finish college. Child care and low-income car loans.
Mary Kay, positing some solutions to the dilemma we face. Care to comment on that, Professor?
I think those are all great solutions. Again, we want to be thinking about, you know, the reality of what it is today is that we're supporting families and individuals. Training is going to be a part of it. Like you mentioned earlier, that the labor force has shifted, so people moving forward, new generations, new cohorts, have to have different skills. This is something we need to realize, though, that it's not just simply getting a job that's going to alleviate poverty, but it's going to be having better skills, getting a better job, having better working and wage conditions for workers across America are really important parts. So we need to think about this. Is not a simple solution. It's going to be a complex one that we're going to need to compromise on to find a way to best solve this situation. But she's right. Those are all good solutions, potentially good solutions for helping to alleviate the working poor.
Well, Mary Kay brought up the outsourcing of jobs overseas. We're in a world market. American workers have to compete. Wages are a lot lower elsewhere. What do we do about that?
I think part of that is the debate we have about labor standards and wages. There's going to be economic pros and cons to all this. We can get people on who can debate the pros and cons to everything that Mary Kay just said, whether or not they're going to be net good or net positive, whether they're the most efficient way of solving this. But again, part of this is that moral component I was saying. Do we want to have a America where people can work and provide for their families? And maybe that's the case, and so that we're going to have to adopt some policies, some answers that maybe aren't the most economically efficient or effective means, but provide a place for American workers. And so maybe helping to protect American wages, American workers, might be a way to help solve the dilemma we're in with working poor.
Here's an email from Amy, who writes, "Sometimes I wonder if the 1% think of us when they put on their imported suit, imported shoes, and drive their imported car to work for a company that is based overseas to avoid taxes. Income inequality, a major issue internationally, that has to play into this working poor thesis as well, doesn't it?"
Yeah, I think that's part of it that plays into it, that we've got these jobs, income inequality, where some of the one percenters are making a lot more relative to the people who are on the assembly line, if you will. And so maybe some policies like that to help make more equitable pay could help alleviate it, so the workers are getting better pay. But I think also getting to her point, I wonder if they think about us. That's at the heart of this study, too, is to try to really push and change how we think about poverty. Because I don't think people were realizing what the working poor was just a few years ago, that we had a different image of the poor, and that we had this idea that, you know, if you worked hard in America, you were going to make it. And so hopefully we can get the one percenters all the way down to the bottom, everyone in America, to realize that who the American poor are today is a different image than it was just a few years ago, certainly different than who it was for my parents. And that we need to realize that the people out there working we interact with every day, they're the ones that need more help. They're the ones that aren't making enough to meet the needs of for themselves or their children.
800-642-1234, the number to call to join our discussion on the Kathleen Dunn Show today, 800-642-1234. We're talking about the problem of the working poor in America and what kind of society we want. What's our moral obligation to maintain a society where people work for a living, that they make enough money to keep a roof over their head and food on the table? Wanting to know what you think about that, 800-642-1234. Email address is talk@wpr.org. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question there. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen, a little under the weather the last couple of days, so everybody's stepping in to take up the slack. Kathleen, we hope that you're feeling better on Monday and can be back here where all your fans expect to hear you. 800-642-1234. My guest is Scott Sanders, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Brigham Young University. There's some brand new research out that we're talking about that seeks to define the working poor in America and give us some idea of who all these people are. 24 million of us out of 46 million who are in poverty, so that's more than half. Professor, did your research reveal anything about those other 22 million people who are in poverty in terms of who they are, the people who are poor but not the working poor? Do we know anything more about them?
Well, so we looked at working poor. So if you expanded the definition of working poor, it would incorporate more of those 46 million. So if you expanded it to its most, we had about 19% of the working population would be working poor if you had a definition where someone who worked at all in a year. So we know that there are people who are working there and are working less than part-time hours. We don't necessarily know why they're getting less than part-time hours. If it's if they were unable to get more hours or unwilling to, we don't know the difference with that. But that's about what we were looking at. We're focusing more there. There's plenty of research that are looking at, you know, the other poor, where we see some of the similar patterns where, you know, single female households are more likely to be poor. Ethnic minorities are more likely to be poor. The same findings we found with working poor play out with the poor as well.
What about age? Is there anything in your research that suggests that one age cohort is in worse shape than another here?
We didn't break this research down by age cohort. We did the 18 to 64, which is looking at people who are considered to be in the working age group, but we didn't look at age groups specific to see that. Is part of the problem with that is when we're looking at younger groups, it's harder to tell if someone's a student or actually full-time employed in the labor market. So we didn't look at the younger groups overall.
So you've referenced this earlier. We've talked about it. We're in case someone just dropped in from the planet Mars. We're in the middle of a political campaign for elections that won't take place for more than another year. We have people running for president and running for a lot of other offices already campaigning. And so there's a lot of rhetoric, a lot of numbers and so forth being tossed around. With all of the candidates making economic growth of the middle class seemingly a priority, is there any message out there that you've heard right now that would seem to be consistent with what you all found in your research?
I think overall, the discussions about growing inequality, about need to create better jobs in America, that's consistent with what we've found. And you have candidates, you know, on varying ways, varying levels and varying views on how to address that. And I think that's an important thing for listeners. And part of what this study helps to bring out is that the assumptions underneath those decisions can change the results dramatically. So if you change the definition of working poor to be only full-time workers or only part-time workers or someone who worked at all, you get vastly different outcomes. And what we need to think about with what our politicians are saying is I don't think there's a politician out there that's going to say, I'm for more inequality or I'm for the poor staying poor. But we need to think about what kind of assumptions they're making underneath their statements, their policies. For example, if they're for if for the working poor, if they have a solution that says we should allow people to to support single earner households, then that helps to support a situation where one partner can stay home and support the kids. If they're saying they want everyone to work, then they need to be also be saying they want to support more child care. These are different, you know, assumptions and different outcomes, but they can mean a difference, because we need to think about the whole picture, how it's affecting children, how it's affecting families and communities, and depending on how they're framing their policies can have radical differences in the outcomes. And so that's the biggest thing, I think, is we need to be careful and conscious of what our politicians are saying, because they're happy to say the words we all want to hear, but their actual policies and ideas may vary dramatically.
Let's take a call before we go to our next break. We'll start in Milwaukee. John is with us. John, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I was wondering, maybe you guys could comment on my couple of ideas here. The Forbes supposedly had an article about a couple of years back about that 300 families in America own half the value of the country, of the United States of America. I don't know if either of you have heard about that. And if they do, I think Huey Long was right that they've taken 90% of the wealth of America to that 0.1% or to 300 families, and that's why the rest of the people don't have enough to live on. And the second thing is the second Pearl Harbor, 9/11, that caused us to go into debt on the defense budget. So now we're spending $2 trillion a year on defense industry and weapons and destruction. And the central bank bailouts, the fraud of the 2008-09 crash and the bailout of the big banks.
Okay. John, we get it. Professor, a lot to chew on there. We've been spending a lot of money on wars overseas and things like that, defense spending. We certainly had that the economic crash of 2008 and its after effects. And you mentioned the point earlier about income inequality. If there's a finite level of resources and one group has more than 90% of them, that makes it pretty tough for the rest.
Yeah, I think what this really helps to, I think we're across America, we're seeing that there is more inequality. And what this paper shows is that inequality isn't due to people being lazy, which sometimes has been the answer for people to justify that inequality. And that's not the case. Most people are out working, trying to provide for their families. And so, according, you know, getting to the caller's point about defense spending, that means we have a large millions of Americans who are the deserving poor who are working hard. And so maybe we need to re-examine how we're spending our money if we think it's vital to continue to use limited resources for foreign wars and foreign military actions, or if that money can be better spent here at home. Because what we're showing is we have millions of Americans working who could greatly benefit from some government assistance because right now their jobs aren't providing their needs. And the other thing I wanted to stress, too, is when we think about this, we're not just helping individuals. So, again, the face of American poverty today is that worker at a fast food store, but that worker may have children. And if we don't take care of the children, that's America in 20 years. So if we're not investing now into people who are working and trying to improve their lives, we're penalizing them, people who are trying to pull themselves up by the bootstraps, but are also penalizing their children, which puts America at a disadvantage in the future if we're not taking care of our citizens now and in the years to come.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have more of our conversation with Scott Sanders and with you at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm Don Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This hour we're talking about the working poor. New research suggests that there are a lot more of them than we had thought. Some surprising numbers coming out of this research. We're talking about that with Scott Sanders, assistant professor of sociology at Brigham Young and one of the researchers who developed this report. We have a lot of callers who want to join the show. Let's start in Seafair. And Tim is on the phone with us. Tim, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. The one thing I'd say is I have a feeling your number is off by about 50 million people, because I don't know if you took in consideration debt, especially credit card debt, since the credit card companies were allowed to rewrite bankruptcy law 5 years ago, and credit card debt is no longer erasable. It stays with you forever. And I just wanted, did you consider not only what people are making, but what they owe?
Well, Tim, I'm really glad you raised that, because I was going to take that from a different perspective, which is student loans. We know now that student loan debt is even bigger than credit card debt. And it is not, you can't get rid of that through bankruptcy either. So, Professor, what about it? Are we low on the numbers because we're not including debts that people can't discharge in bankruptcy?
Yes. The numbers we're using are just income, because that's, again, poverty threshold is based off of income, whether or not you qualify for government assistance. If we put in debt, we somehow incorporated student loans or other consumer debt, that would radically change the landscape. And so I guess it does paint a more grim picture that we have, millions of people not making enough money just to make their basic needs. But if you put on their servicing debts and other problems, it would be much higher than what we've got here. And again, maybe increases the urgency of the situation right now that we do try to make a change to help out the poor in the United States.
Well, and then that's also money that is not available for stimulating the economy. I mean, if you're mm-hmm. forced to, if you have to pay, for example, all those student loans, that's money that you're not using to buy a car or some other manufactured goods in the country, and that money doesn't go anywhere in the community.
Yeah, if we go back to the official poverty line of $24,000 for a family of four, if you've got to service, $500 worth of debt a month, that eats into how much you can spend in your community to help stimulate this, but also how much you can provide for your family, the quality of food you can make, the quality of education, other basic needs that you may be having, which then may lead to increased debt because you're not able to meet your needs, and so you have to take on more consumer debt just to get by month to month.
We'll go to Williams Bay next, where Joan is with us. Joan, good afternoon.
Yes, hello. What an interesting subject. Working poor, I never heard of it before. I'm old enough to remember the poor. You wanted to stay out of being poor, where you didn't have food to eat, and it being a quiet, personal thing. And now it's like encouraged, And I'm wondering also about the rules which favor the wealthy and not everyone. And if we should look at those and see if there's something should be changed in the rules.
Joan, if I could ask you a question, what do you mean by it's being encouraged? Are we encouraging people to be working poor?
Sure, with using your credit card and buying all the ads that we use. 80% of the TV time is devoted to ads with what you should have. That's very tempting. And so people go out and get a credit card maybe, or when one comes in the mail, they even mail them to you. Yeah, you go and use it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Joan, thank you. Professor?
I think this gets to her point, gets to the one earlier, that in addition to what we found, the millions of Americans who are working and unable to provide their basic needs, there's many more millions that are probably out there being able to get their meet their needs through consumer debt, and then sooner or later that debt's going to come back to get them. So it is an issue. And again, getting to her comment about do we reevaluate the rules that benefit the wealthy, this is where this moral and economic argument need to come together. Do we want to have a country where anybody, not just the wealthy, not just those who happen to be born to a certain family, can go out and get a job that provides for their needs? Do we want the American dream to be a reality? If so, then we need to make some changes to some policies to give better assistance to the poor and probably the near poor as well, so we can help more people who have debt, not just those that are under the poverty line, but just maybe those that are just barely above it as well, to give more aid to people who need it, who are crippled by student consumer debt and just barely making it check by check.
Let's take another call, and this one relates to what we were just talking about. Rebecca is with us from Dundee. Rebecca, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. My comment, as you said, was similar to an earlier caller, looking on this debt that we have, but mine is more from the perspective of being caused by the recession, where we had people that were normally able to provide for themselves of all different ages, elderly to the well-established, middle-aged, and 30-something, all of a sudden were living off of credit cards, not because they wanted to,
mm-hmm.
but because they had no other way to pay their bills. And
okay.
My husband himself, we were off of work for 2 years. We will never be able to pay off that debt, and we didn't want to claim bankruptcy. We wanted to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca, thanks for sharing your story. I would think, Professor, that's a fairly common refrain.
Yeah, and that's the unfortunate thing now is we have so many people who are trying to do the right thing, like this caller, trying to work hard, trying to make it, and simply aren't. And so when we talk about these policy changes or giving more government assistance, it's not, again, to people who are living off the system and just want to check and sit at home. We're talking about Americans, our neighbors, the people we interact with every day who just need a little bit of help. You know, if you think about it, if you're living check to check, a little bit, a couple hundred extra dollars a month can be a big windfall for people. So changing some of the government aid, government support policies and labor standards can be make a big difference in a lot of Americans' lives who are working, who don't want to be in the situation, but due to the recession or other situations have found themselves in hard times. And you know that's one of the big take homes I hope of this paper is we just again need to realize the working poor, that's a different image of who the poor are today. There's a lot of Americans out there trying to do what's right, trying to improve their livelihood, and maybe just need a little help. Hopefully we live in a country that's willing to reach out and give that helping hand.
I have to say that the description of your research sounds like something that I might have read in a novel by Charles Dickens.
Yeah, it's shocking that we've got this situation now where we are. It's instead of, you know, the factories of the Dickens novels, it's the low-paid service industry that we're getting. So we interact. Each one of us interacts every day with the working poor, whether we know it or not. And those people out there doing jobs that help provide services and goods for us aren't able to sometimes pay for those services and goods themselves.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Mike in Franklin next. Mike, hello.
Yeah, here's what my problem is, what's happening in our country. So many people right now are working harder, longer hours for less money and less benefits than ever. And the big problem is we have politicians like Scott Walker and Paul Ryan, and they denigrate these people. They make it sound like we're the people that need help are somehow they're not worthy of it, okay? But they are because they're working hard. It's called people working but not earning enough to take care of themselves and their families. We need brave politicians to stand up for all Americans.
Mike, thanks for your call. Professor?
I would encourage callers like Mike and others to support and contact their politicians to let them know that the image of poverty is different. And so when you hear rhetoric about people living off the system and exploiting it, that's true. There's a small percentage of people who are probably that way, but the vast majority are, like what Mike was saying, are working hard, trying to do it, that we need to realize that that's who the working poor are. That's poverty in America today, and that's the poverty in America we're going to face in the years to come unless we do something. People are working, trying to do something about it. So we need to encourage our politicians to recognize that shift in poverty and have them support Americans who are out working hard but might need a little help right now.
Mike, thanks for that call. Abe in Milwaukee, you'll be next. Abe, hello.
Hi, this is Dave.
Oh, I'm sorry.
What I like to say is, I've been saying this for years, is that we've been shipping jobs overseas forever, manufacturing jobs. And manufacturing jobs are jobs that pay well for all people from the top to the bottom. And I believe it's management's fault because you can go to these foreign countries, you can pollute as much as you want, there's no labor laws. That makes people dislike us overseas. And why don't we invest in our own people? It tells me they don't like Americans, that's what I think.
Okay. Abe, thanks for the call. Professor?
Globalization certainly has impacted the United States, and is probably one of the reasons why we see the shift in the working poor. Because some of those jobs that were good before are no longer here. So we need to be able to realize that there's been a shift and help those people who were once dependent on jobs, and we may not get back anymore. And that the economy is a different economy now. So, but we need to support Americans, and if we want to have an America where people can work hard, have that American dream, we need to help them out. Maybe that's through increased job training. Maybe that's through government helping to support or protect certain industries or development of new industries for new and better jobs in America. All these come together, but we need to realize that Americans are willing to work but might need some help from the government through these various mechanisms.
Well, I mean, the American dream may not even be attainable anymore for most people. Isn't it possible what we might have to settle for is making sure that everyone has a roof over their head and food to eat?
Yeah, I think that's the case right now, unless we do something about it. And that's something, you know, for me, I'm hoping as a researcher, I get a little optimistic that hopefully we can make changes and can improve it, bring that American dream back to be a reality. But if nothing changes now, you're right. The American dream isn't a possibility for many people. And maybe even just getting a roof over your head is going to be difficult for millions of Americans.
Well, I mean, you know, we've been talking about for years, well, you know, it's that 1.6 children and a split entry in the suburbs, two cars in the driveway and a dog playing in the yard. A lot of people would settle for having three meals a day and being in out of the weather.
Yeah, and that's, again, this paper helps to realize some of the images, some of the assumptions we made no longer are accurate. This is done with data after the recession, and this is the reality we're living in now.
Okay.
Is some of these views of the world and of America aren't accurate anymore. We may want to hold on to them because they're nice, warm images, but they don't depict the reality right now.
Let's take another call. Dan is with us from Iron Mountain, Michigan, which is, my mother grew up in Kingsford, so that's a familiar part of the country to me. Dan, good afternoon. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to point out something. I had recently been watching John Oliver's show, and he did a bit on inequality, and he pulled up a graph showing recent times that the lower people in companies are making less than 1/300th of what the higher ups in the company are making, compared to previous times of growth in which it was in the low 20s. So like your lower people in the company would be making 1/20th compared to, say, a CEO or heads of the company.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that maybe some sort of a regulation to close that gap would be a really good answer for that. I'd like to take your opinion here.
Yeah, that's the ratio between the top pay and bottom pay in a corporation. It has been growing. You can see it in inequality literature. It's been a big problem over the United States, and it's grown more in the United States relative to other industrialized nations. It certainly would be one solution we could propose and implement that would help provide better salaries and better wages for workers, which then would hopefully result in alleviating the working poor and reducing the number of Americans that are working and not making their basic needs.
Well, and I think Jake in Oshkosh has a question that addresses that very issue. Jake, quickly, we're at the end of the hour.
Quickly, John, what does the guest think about minimum wage versus living wage? And related to that, I don't believe in minimum wage. I believe in a variable living wage, meaning you're going to have a different living wage in various parts of the country because of the cost of living.
Okay, Jake, thanks. The difference between minimum wage and living wage, Professor.
Yeah, so that's one of the arguments that we suggest in the paper. It could be a way to help resolve this, is increasing the minimum wage to a living wage, or at least increasing it in general, so that the wages that people are making can actually meet their needs. This goes back to that economic moral issue, that maybe this may not be the most economic sound thing. You can certainly find labor economists who will find it as an awful solution. But I think it also helps us to provide a better situation for Americans, that we should live in a society, I think it's morally important that we live in a society where people are working, can have a living wage, can meet their basic needs, if they're playing by the rules and trying to help their children and their families.
All right, Professor, certainly a lot more that we could talk about on this issue, and I have a hunch it'll come up again on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Sanders, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Brigham Young University, one of the researchers who came up with these numbers of the working poor. Thanks a lot to K.P. Whaley, who handled production duties today, both on and off air, and Michelle Good, who also provided assistance this afternoon. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Hopefully Kathleen will be back on Monday. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.